This is Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Today is November 28th, and it is not quite Monday at noon, but you will be listening to this at Monday at noon as well as right now. We're going to run this program twice today. This is Epic Story Hour with Fanny Crawford at www.enlightenradio.org. And our theme for today's program is giving thanks and appreciation. I hope your Thanksgiving celebration over this past week was a good one. Today's broadcast will include some traditional stories, some family or personal stories to explore this idea of gratitude. And I have John Case in the studio today, and he's promised to share a bit of labor history with us. He's going to tell a story that fits with our theme on his specialty, of course, labor history and his experience. Good morning, John.
Good morning. It's a slightly enhanced history.
Storytellers know all about enhanced histories. Okay, I'm going to hold you off for a few minutes because I have some announcements to make. And actually, John's going to tell this story in two parts, I believe, because it's a long one. So you're going to do two 10-minute segments. Is that what the plan is? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I'm going to tell a couple stories as well. So we have a lot going on today, and I hope you will have time to stay tuned and listen to these fascinating storytellers you're going to hear this morning, Fanny Crawford and John Case. The first thing I wanted to do in terms of announcements was to make sure everybody in the area knows that Adam Booth will be telling stories tonight at Stories in the Round, which is the storytelling venue in Hagerstown that I coordinate. He'll be there at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Sear Foss Pike. That's 13245 Sear Foss Pike, which is Salem Avenue, extended west in Hagerstown. And if you want to register in advance for that session, you can get a few bucks off. You can call me and leave a message with your name and anybody you are bringing with you for the registration list. That's 301-730-1638. You can also contact me via email at Fanitsky, F as in Fanny, A N as in no, I T S K Y, at hotmail.com. And I need to put your name on the registration list for you to get that discount. It's $12 at the door, $10 in advance. Adam will be starting at 7 p.m. this evening, so I hope you're able to join us. Also, Adam's storytelling series in Shepherdstown will have its final session in December. That's December 13th, Tuesday, the second Tuesday has been the traditional date for that. And he has two tellers coming from the West Virginia Storytelling Guild, Joanne Dottisman and Fred Powers. And they were the winners of a jurying by a group of their peers who chose them to be the representatives for the guild this season. And they're going to close out Adam's Speak Story season at the community building. You may know it as the Men's Club or the War Memorial Building, but it's now called the Community Building, next to the library on Main Street or German Street in Shepherdstown. And his session starts at 7:30. So you want to come at 7 tonight to hear Adam in Hagerstown, but if you're coming on December 13th, you'll come at 7:30. And to reach Adam to get tickets, you can go to speakwv.org. You can also contact Adam by phone and reach him at 304-886-9481. Those tickets are also $12 at the door, $10 in advance. Checking times with John. John, what time do we have?
What does it say? We have whatever time we need. What time do we?
Well, I'm trying because we're recording this not on the hour when we would actually start. I guess I've been talking for about 7 minutes. Okay. So I'm going to let John start his labor history story in two parts. Right. And hang on, if you need to step away, you will want to come back and make sure you hear the full shebang. Take it away, John.
Working in a machine shop in the Connecticut River Valley of northern New England, if you wanted to include Massachusetts in northern New England, you could. However, the true northern New Englanders refer to Massachusetts citizens as Flatlanders, whereas the Flatlanders refer to Vermonters as people whose legs are different lengths because they spend all their lives walking on hills. So there's a mutual denigration that takes place at times. Nonetheless, in the Machine Valley, which runs all along the Connecticut River from St. Johnsbury, Vermont, all the way through Connecticut, there are many both historical and even some current remnants of the great machine tool industry that arose in the United States and was played a major role in industrialization. The ones up in the northern New England along the Connecticut River tended to be manufacturing machine tools primarily, although not exclusively, for the automobile industry. And one of the characteristic features of these shops, regardless of their management styles or whether even they were unionized or not, is that by the time you work 30 years in a machine shop and have been exposed to every sort of corrosive and lubricating solvent known to man, your chances of acquiring a cancer of some sort are very, very high. And so much so that the laudable benefits of numerous machine tool companies, which they had in their public employment publications about how generous their retirement benefits were, they weren't lying, except that you did not live long enough to collect them in any, you know, anything like the numbers they were picturing when you got hired or were told about your wonderful pension benefits. So this led to the one of the factors that led to the organization of this plant in Windsor, Vermont, which was called Cone Blanchard back then, but it was bought by a conglomerate. As a matter of fact, it had been bought by a conglomerate shortly before the story I'm about to tell actually begins. And but you need to know the background is that after a 10-year struggle, the local union had succeeded in acquiring its number one objective for the half of the plant that was probably over 45. And that was full retirement. In other words, your full benefits, you know, not actuarially reduced, to be collectible at age 62. You know, with no reduction.
That's quite an achievement.
And the reason for this was that full retirement at 65 lasted about a year, and then you died of cancer, you know, at 66.
Statistics were not on your side.
So we had fought for, you know, 10 years, and it finally achieved under the company when it had been an independently owned company called Cone Blanchard, was very, very prized thing. And I got to Vermont, of course, about 3 years after this victory. And the company had been purchased by a conglomerate, and one of their initial first demands was that they were going to get rid of full retirement at age 62 under the new corporate configuration. Well, this was a, you know, strong local union. I mean, the machine shops are made up of fellows that may not have a gigantic amount of education, but tend to have quite a bit of skill. And because doing fine machine work, at least before the age of total automation, was a very difficult craft. And accuracy and productivity together was a valuable thing to find somebody who could do. But nevertheless, the membership decided that under no circumstances were they going to abandon their full retirement at age 62. And the motivation was in part money, but also in part this issue of why, what good is it if you can't collect it? Right. So anyway, the president of the local was a new guy who got elected on the it's about a 500-600 member shop. Got elected on the promise to retain and protect this retirement benefit, as well as some other things for the younger workers. But you know, mainly, you know, the muscle, the passion was over retirement. Well, we made no ground. We made no progress whatsoever in negotiations. Absolutely none. They wouldn't budge on it, but they also would not tell us why. Hmm. And they started throwing a considerable amount of money on the table in the form of, you know, wages and insurance benefits and an extra holiday and like this. But I mean, they would not move on this demand to get rid of the full retirement at age 62. It was an open and shut case. The called a membership meeting and took a strike vote, and the strike vote was 99%. There was one defector.
Hmm.
Okay, to shut the place down. And even that strike vote made virtually no impression. Actually, well, it made an impression on the company, sort of threatening us all, with everything, you know, all lawsuits, the whole business, whatever they had, they were going to threaten us with. They were going to hire strikebreakers and their new conglomerate thing could afford to, you know, bring people in from the other side of the ocean if they wanted to. So, nonetheless, we went on strike. And it was a bitter strike. It lasted, I would say, you know, it was, we were 8-9 weeks into it. And, you know, so I start as the rep and everything and trying to hold it together. I started getting calls from my director of organization saying, what are you doing up there, buddy? Any chance of these people ever getting back to work? I said, well, we're stuck on this thing, and the guys are just, they feel like it's, you know, their pastors are delivering sermons and supporting them in the churches, and they're, you know, the town's on their side. It ain't a very big town, but it's on their side. And so I said, well, I'll come up. So I won't take too much time to describe the man that came up. He was had the energy of seven men and was...
an American hero.
He was an interesting fella, you know. He was a little bit like the first Quaker that attended the Constitutional Convention, which General Washington introduced as a man of peace made mm-hmm. of iron. Anyway, he came up and he went in and met with the company. And they came back out, and I said, so what happened? And he said, well, they said to tell you that you haven't been reading the proposal carefully enough. I said to him, well, what does that mean? He said, you tell me. Go read the effing proposal, you know? And, oh, man, I started to feel like, what had I missed? And... So I did study the proposal again. We must have read it 100 times. And the thing we missed is that buried in the pension proposal of cutting the full retirement was a much increased actual actuarial benefit at 65. But so much increased that even with a reduction based on the old scheme at age 62, you'd still be making more money going out at 62 now with a reduction than you would have 8 weeks ago with the out reduction of the old rate.
So the company understood the position, understood the union's position.
This had to be calculated based on some, you know, the problem we didn't see it was they had a formula in there that we weren't using the right formula.
Okay.
Anyway, this started a bloodbath, almost literally.
Within the union.
Yes, because now we had the still impassioned people saying, well, this is just giving a people incentive to not go out at 62 and to die at 66, right? And we're standing out here on a principle. I says, yeah, but The principle is you're getting paid about $12 a week strike pay. And, the economic thing is they've put a ton of money on the table, and effectively they forced them to put everything they have on the table, actually. But then we had the people that are on stand on principle, even in the midst of the fires of hell, and those that are saying, look, there's no money in it. We're only here for the money fundamentally, right? You know, and so the fight was a bad vote. Only about 60-40 to accept the deal, which the local and the national union and championed as an unbelievable victory. And it was. Nobody else anywhere near for 3 years before or 3 years after ever got that kind of percentage settlement out of any of the New England machine tool companies. So we won, but we felt like we lost.
Yeah, so divisive.
5 years later, that plant closed. So as a part of a conglomeration parable that would take another story to tell. But anyway, that's part one.
Wow. Well, I'm just all stoked to hear part two. You're leaving us hanging. You've definitely got me engaged and connected. Thank you, John. Listeners, you are listening to Epic Story Hour at www.enlightenradio.org. This is Fanny Crawford, your story host, and you've been listening to part one of a labor history personal story from station manager John Case. I've already announced the Stories in the Round series, at which Adam Booth, Shepherdstown's own Adam Booth, will be telling stories of the season this evening in Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike, the Unitarian Universalist Church there. And I hope you're able to come out and hear Adam. You can get tickets in advance by calling me at 301-730-1638. Adam's own storytelling series, the final session of that series will run December 13th, and Joanne Dottisman and Fred Powers from the West Virginia Storytelling Guild will be there 7:30 at the community building in Shepherdstown. Stories in the Round this evening starts at 7. Please give me a call if you want to be on the advanced registration list. But we are all sitting here waiting for part two, this cliffhanger of a story from John Case. And when John Case has finished his story, you want to stay tuned beyond that, because I have a couple stories of my own that I'm going to share with you. And there'll be more to come. So, John, part two.
All right, well, part two takes place about a year later. We're talking about the early 80s here. Downriver, about 12 miles from the Cone Blanchard plant, there was a plant that goes all the way back in its history to the Civil War, originally called the Springfield Rifle Company.
I've heard of them.
And they were the rifle manufacturer to make it out of interchangeable parts. And that's what they became famous
for.
Yeah,
that's what I know them for.
And that made it possible, of course, to repair rifles in the field. Before then, most rifles were custom made. And if one part of it broke, you had to go back and almost rebuild the whole thing, because the hammer or the rifling, if there was any, depending on what year you got yourself a rifle, were different. And there were no interchangeable parts. And so basically, if the rifle broke, you had to get a brand new one. But the introduction of replaceable parts was the founding of the Springfield Rifle Company. And there's a museum, actually, in the same town as Cone Blanchard in, which has parts of the original Springfield Rifle Company in Springfield, Vermont. And the waterworks that was used to power that mill, all made with wood and and pulleys and belts, where you would take the power of the river and find ways to transfer it to.
It's still standing?
The museum is still there, and you can go all the way downstairs in a little windowed-in thing right to the river level and see the old works that have been, you know, pretty, I would say, more or less preserved and prepared. They have a little part of it that runs to give you an idea of what of the kind of linkages that it takes to have this happen. And one of the features of these old mills that were on the river, okay, is that the old works is down below. And then later, when other sources of power besides the river became more reliable, like coal, to fire, you know, the electricity required to run one of these mills, you had, you know, works upon works upon works. And, you know, one of the initial initiations of new employees was to send them on an errand to go down into the old works. And if they crawled down there, they have to put your boots on, you know, because without your boots, you might be stepping on rodents barefooted, or in a way you might not want to. Anyway, it was considered a very mean task to, somewhat fearful. I remember when my wife was first working in a paper mill, she got one of those tasks too. The same thing. They all also were old river powered mills, right? But anyway, in this, so I my first visit to this plant, Jones and Lamson, was the inheritor of the Springfield Rifle Company and a couple of other incarnations in between, and they made also turret lathes for the automobile industry. The year after this struggle I was talking about upriver, which was in Windsor, Vermont, J&L, we used to call it, had been purchased by Textron, a conglomerate. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the basics of a conglomerate, is that you buy a company that's in the one phase of the business cycle, and then you buy a company that's in the opposite phase of the business cycle. For example, when in the old days before great financial crises, automobiles had a downturn, well, they would use the downturn to retool their plants and upgrade their machines, and so it would be kind of an up thing for the machine tools, right? They'd go up while auto went down, and it would be a nice balancing act. And the conglomerate, you know, guys thought, well, gee, what a great thing. I'll have a company that never loses money. You know, when one's losing, the other's winning, and, you know, it'll be complementary, and we can do that. Of course, the weakness in that is that once you start buying lots of different companies, none of which are your core business, business is a balancing act, okay? Then, you know, your devotion to that particular industry may slip. Okay, and you may be subject to just the winds of global finance and other things. And this is what happened to us, is that they'd been bought by Textron, and things had gone along fine for about two contracts, about 6 years. And then they came in and fundamentally, in economic terms, proposed to have us, you know, be willingly raped and robbed of everything we had fought for 50 years in that particular mill. That particular mill was the foundation of all organizing drives in Vermont and New England for a long time. It's a very militant trade union shop. Those guys struck that plant five times in 50 years, and they did it to force the wages to be competitive with the automobile industry. And they drove it up, and they drove it up through an incentive system, a piecework system that was incredibly productive, but that the workers got paid for one. And that was considered a crowning achievement. And the fact that they kept making so much money at that, all the other machine tool companies in the valley, almost all of them, even if they were beautifully managed and had wonderful Christian folks running them, et cetera, they were all organized because none of them could keep up with that kind of money.
Yeah,
and I used to visit people and say, "I'd like to join the union." So I hear you guys go on strike. I says, "Yeah, but we win." He says, "That's a pretty good argument, you know." Not that you ever really get back the money from a strike, but you do raise the rate anyway. So here we are in J&L, proud shop, you know, strong union, blah blah blah. But pretty practical, willing to work hard for everything, right? And the company says, "We're going to take it all apart and just, you know, insurance, pensions, the piece rates, everything." And see, that's, and they hired a lawyer to tell us, of course, you know, that, mm. that we were, you know, this was like a deck, a sign. We're sending you a general, a gunfighter, you know, to get you the news, right? And it was no problem whatsoever getting this shop ready to, you know, just do it, have a revolution right there. I mean, they were just completely together about, we didn't have to do an ounce of agitation. All I did was just reprinted the speech of the lawyer. But then a weird thing happened. Somebody in the shop, and I still to this day do not know who it was, but the chief steward called me up on the phone in the middle of the night, says, "I got something to show you." I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Nah, I can't tell you about it. I got to show it to you." So we meet together down at the Duck Inn in Springfield. He used to call it the Duck Inn and Waddle Out. It was right between the three machine tool companies in town. Anyway, went in there, we met, and he showed me this document, which he claimed had fallen off a truck, and it was a memorandum from the corporate industrial relations department of Textron to the local management at Jones and Lamson, their now wholly owned division. And it said, I'm going to summarize here in somewhat coarser terms, "Why don't you suck the union into going on strike, and then we'll use that to blame them and move the company out of town, and it'll be all their fault."
That sounds like textbook labor strategies.
Yeah. But it was an actual, I mean, and this whole thing was an attempt to get us to shut it down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, "Oh, well, no one loves us. We're going to move out. And by the way, we're going to break all of our obligations to the state and everybody else, you know, because the workers just, we don't have any liabilities at all, you know, and just, we're out of here." And, well, so the difficult problem now, how to raise this particular information with the membership. And, but we had no choice but to do it. And we had a meeting of our extended leadership, really, basically all the stewards and everybody. I remember we had it in a closed-door meeting, and we read the entire memorandum, which is about four or five pages long. It's original. And another bloodbath ensued. And it was a very, very difficult discussion. That they had were provoking us into a strike that was sucker bait of some sort, you know, and but that here we were going to basically cut the incomes and the benefits in half and leave people with next to nothing. Okay, so and I don't know how I don't remember how the idea arose. I know that we'd been meeting for a couple hours and we'd taken a break and we were going to come back, and when we came back, this fellow from actually a pretty new employee, actually, but good guy, and his parents had worked in the mill. I think his parents' uncles had worked in the mill too. Went way back. He had a two jobs. One job was he was a machinist, and the other job was that he was an auctioneer. All right, and he also, loved to. He had enough land that he would harvest a bunch of maple syrup. I learned about sugaring from watching him do it. Okay, wonderful fellow. And he says, "Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we agree to the proposal on one condition? Agree to all of it, and the condition would be is that pay the insurance for all the people that lose their jobs for 2 years, and set up a scholarship fund for every one of their children." And I think a couple of other things in there. And because it's over, right? I mean, it's over.
Right, either way.
It's over.
Yeah.
So why don't we pay it forward somehow? And, I can't say that the bloodbath did not continue. The name calling, some rather coarse references to different opinions, and but in the end, we decided on that strategy. And we didn't actually go to the full membership right away because, you know, there was quite a bit of questions about whether any approach on this would work with the company in any event. But we did, in advance, get a hold of as many of our friends in the press, and because we were, you know, the largest union in Vermont at that time, we had quite a few friends. And we got a narrative together that we were going to pitch and that they were going to help us with as well once it became public, okay? And we also happened to get the Republican governor, whose name was Phil Hoff. Actually, he was a Democrat. He was the first Democrat in 100 years in Vermont. And he had been a Republican. He became a Democrat. Anyway, we got him, okay, to be attracted to the idea. A conversation between the fellow I told you about before, my director of organization, and him. So the gunfighter lawyer was still there, and they said we agree to all of it on these very limited conditions. And we wish you bon voyage as we handed the fallen off the truck document across the table. Well, you know, he made a big long speech, blah 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 blah. This, and I was writing down every word, and some other guy was actually recording it.
This is the lawyer.
The lawyer.
Yeah.
And then we let the whole press in on the whole thing, gave him the tape of the thing. The next day, the newspapers just screamed about what monsters these guys were and how selfless and forward-looking the union was, ready to fall on their swords for the sake of their children and retirees. Well, we went in the next day and the lawyer was gone.
Funny thing about that.
The actual industrial rep from Textron was there and said, well, do we get any credit for doing this too? I said, sure, absolutely. Do the right thing. We'll take photos if you want to, not if you really... And they took him about a week. They must have had to go back to Textron Olympus of some sort and consult with the CEO or whatever. But they did it. And so we had this party, and we invited the folks from Windsor down, which is part one of the story, mm-hmm. Cohen Blanchard. And we, I think in UE News, we published a tale of the two strikes. And a narrative that which everybody loved was that in part one, we won, but we felt like we lost. But in part two, we lost, but we felt like we won.
That's an amazing story, John. You did the right thing. You came up with a solution that rose above the blood.
Yes.
The massacre to look ahead. And that's what won the hearts and minds of the onlookers. Well, and I'm sure the town as a whole was highly invested.
Yeah, we had a good reputation out of that, you know, as it turned out. I mean, even not that everybody still loved us, but we had some dignity in the process. Yeah.
Wonderful,
so I'll mention the two names. That's the... Francis Columbia was the leader of the local in Windsor, Vermont, Cohen Blanchard, and a guy named Bobby Farnsworth was the leader in J&L.
Mm. Are they still with us? They're probably long gone.
They're both gone.
You're an old guy yourself.
I'm only 10, counting backwards from 40.
Right. Okay. You're listening to The Epic Story Hour at Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, Epic Radio. You've been listening to John Case tell a labor history story from New England of his days in a machine shop as the union representative. The old days. This is the 80s, you were saying.
Yes, the early 80s.
Early 80s. Yeah. Quite a story. Thank you, John. Our theme today on the Epic Story Hour is appreciation, this idea of gratitude that you've probably been thinking about yourselves, listeners, for the past week or so. and struggling with obligations and family relationships and getting along in the world, meeting everybody's expectations just in terms of getting together. Eating dinner together can be a struggle. And I've decided to take the next week to continue my contemplation of this concept of appreciation. Even when the going gets rough, it's important to stop and reflect and take stock of why exactly we're doing this work and who benefits and who we're including in our circle, who helps us make it all happen, and what the outcomes are, what we want those outcomes to be, and how to be clear about those. I'm going to tell a traditional story myself. You might want to sit back a bit and take a breath, because this is totally different type of story than we just heard from John Case. A very, very old story that I first heard as a child. And since I've been telling this story more often as an adult, I'm getting into deeper layers of the story and thinking about the elements of appreciation and gratitude that are woven through this story. So this is a story from the Iroquois Nation. It's from the Haudenosaunee, the people of the lodge, the people of the longhouse. Once upon a time, long, long ago, when the people were just learning how to feed themselves and their children, there were three sisters. And the sisters did not live in the longhouse. The sisters lived in a big field. All three sisters were gifted and beautiful and strikingly different from each other in the clothing they wore, in their size, and in their temperaments. The youngest sister, called Beans, was very small and frail and delicate. She had to twine herself around her sisters just to stand. And as she struggled to hold onto them and stand tall so that she could spread her leaves in the bright sunshine and grow stronger, she really depended on them for their help. She always dressed in shades of green, from the palest of pale greens, the color of lake water when you hold it in the palm of your hand, to the deepest, darkest greens of fir trees. She was close to her sisters. She loved her sisters dearly. The second sister, the middle sister, was called Squash, and she dressed in a brilliant yellow dress. And on days when the sun shone bright and hot in the sky, she loved to spread her green overskirts over the roots of herself and her sisters, and then run off by herself to the far ends of the field. She'd run as fast as she could. The third sister, the oldest sister, was Corn, and she stood always straight and tall above the other sisters, guarding them faithfully. She was always there for them to lean on. She wore a pale green shawl over her multicolored dress, and she had long yellow hair that tossed about her head in the breeze. There were many ways those three sisters were different, but one way in which they were the same. They loved one another dearly, and they were never separated. If you had asked, they would have said, they could not imagine living apart for very long. Well, one bright sunny day, a stranger came to the field of the three sisters. This was a young boy, almost a man, of the Haudenosaunee, the child of the people of the Longhouse. And he was as straight as an arrow, fearless as the eagle that circles the sky above his head. And he knew the language of the birds and the five small brothers of the earth, the fox, the groundhog, the squirrel, the chipmunk, and the shrew. The three sisters, the one who was just about to crawl, the youngest one, the one in the yellow dress with the green overskirts, and the one with the yellow flowing hair, they were very interested in this young man. And they watched him fit an arrow into his bow. They watched him carve a bowl with his stone knife, and they wondered where he went at sundown every night to sleep, because he came more than once. He came several times over the course of that summer. Well, late in the summer of the first coming of the Haudenosaunee child to their field, one of the three sisters vanished. That was the youngest sister in green, the one who could not yet stand without her sister's help. And her sisters mourned for her, but she did not return. Again, the child of the Haudenosaunee came to the field of the three sisters. He came to gather reeds at the edge of a stream to make his arrow shafts. And the two sisters who were left watched him and gazed with wonder at the trail of footprints his moccasins left in the earth. And then the second of the sisters left, the one who was dressed in yellow and always wanted to run away. She left no trail of her going. It may have been that she set her feet in the moccasin tracks of that boy child. Now there was only one sister left. Corn stood tall and straight in the field, not once bowing her head in sorrow, but it seemed to her that she could not live there without her beloved sisters. The days grew shorter and the nights were colder. Her green shawl was faded and tattered, blowing in the wind, and her once long and golden hair was dry and tangled by the wind. Day and night she watched across the field for her sisters' return, but they did not see or hear her. Her voice, when she called to them, was low and plaintive, like the wind. But one day, in the season of the harvest, the child of the Haudenosaunee heard the crying of the third sister left to mourn there in the field. He heard her sadness, and taking her in his arms, he carried her to the longhouse of his mother and father. And there, in that lodge, were her two lost sisters, safe and well, and so glad to see her. They had been curious about this child of the Haudenosaunee, and they had followed him home to see how and where he lived. They liked his warm lodge. They had decided now that winter was coming, they would stay with him. And they were doing all they could to be useful to this family. The little sister, the one who once could only crawl, she was now quite grown up and was helping to keep the dinner pot full. The sister in yellow, called Squash, sat on the shelf, waiting to cut off little bits of herself to add to the pot, because she knew that her flesh would come again, would grow again, and she was generous with it. The third sister, the eldest sister, Corn, joined them. She was ready to grind meal for the child and his people. And so those three sisters were never separated again. And every spring, the people of the Longhouse plant the three sisters together in a single mound, again and again across the fields where the sun shines brightest, to feed themselves and their children. That's an Iroquois tale, the tale of the three sisters, the legend of the three sisters, the mainstays of Native American cuisine, beans, corn, and squash. And I first heard that story as a child. Every summer, my family would take family vacations up to Western New York, where my dad's family lived, where my dad grew up. Olean, New York, Jamestown, New York. And right near there is the Seneca Reservation and the Kinzua Dam, which was a huge controversial installation that flooded, oh, something like half of the Seneca land back in the middle of the 1900s, in the 60s, I believe. And I heard the Kinzua Dam stories, which were new stories, and I heard old legends. And because I was a child and soaking all this up, it really became part of my personal history in a way. And most years we would, more recently, I've been going to the Seneca Museum in Salamanca, New York. And I always learn something every time I go. So I'm grateful to have been exposed to that storytelling tradition at such an early age, and to feel like I have some version of permission to tell those stories and share them with you. You're listening to the Epic Story Hour on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Our theme today on the Radio Hour is appreciation and this idea of gratitude. And we're taking time to extend beyond the Thanksgiving holiday to think about how our stories fit with our community, what stories we want to be telling, what stories we need to be telling. We heard a story early in the hour from John Case, station manager, from his work and labor organizing experiences. I do want to tell you that Adam Booth, Shepherdstown's own storytelling favorite son, will be telling stories this evening at Stories in the Round in Hagerstown. That's at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 13245 Searfoss Pike. That'll start at 7 this evening. If you'd like to register in advance, you're welcome to come. Just show up at the door. That'll cost you $12. But if you want to register in advance, you can get a bit of a discount on that. And you can reach me at 301-730-1638. I also want to make sure everybody in our listening audience knows that Adam Booth's own storytelling series, Speak, will feature two members of the West Virginia Storytelling Guild, Joanne Dottisman and Fred Powers. Fred Powers is another labor history hero in some ways. He's a coal miner and was a teacher. And usually when he tells, I haven't checked to see if this will happen this time, but most in most storytelling venues, he brings with him a collection of West Virginia coal mining artifacts, paraphernalia, things that he's well-versed in himself as a former coal miner. And that's on December 13th. That'll be the last session in the storytelling series for this season, 7:30 p.m. at the community building in Shepherdstown next to the library on German Street, Main Street in Shepherdstown. I think I have time for one more story this morning. Going to tell a family story, a personal story, a Thanksgiving story. This is called Bolivar Cakes. When I was a child in Philadelphia in the 1950s, Thanksgiving started at our house, at the Crawford House, almost a week before Thanksgiving Day. On Saturday morning, before Thanksgiving, my dad would prepare a shopping list of everything we needed for Thanksgiving dinner, and we'd go down the street and around the corner to the old A&P grocery store. And I loved to go to that grocery store because as you walked in the door, you could smell the roasting coffee. And as you walked by the coffee grinder in the middle of the store, you were overwhelmed with the sense of fresh coffee being ground. And we didn't do this every week, but most weeks my dad would buy a pound or a couple pounds of coffee. My parents drank coffee all day long if they were home. It wasn't unusual for them to have 15 or 20 cups of coffee apiece. So we bought a lot of coffee in our family. But on Thanksgiving before, or the Saturday before Thanksgiving, we were there on a mission. We were there to collect the things we needed for Thanksgiving dinner. And because I was a kid, this was, I was 4, 5, 6 years old at that point. And I thought my job was to make sure my dad didn't leave anything off the list, to make sure we got everything we needed, tiny little white onions so he could make creamed onions for Thanksgiving dinner, sweet potatoes so he could make candied sweet potatoes, and parsnips, because he always made parsnips in orange sauce for our special dinner. Lots of things on that list. But this particular year, he seemed more interested in talking about fruitcake, Bolivar cakes. And he reminded me as we walked through the grocery store that he had shared with me the story of Bolivar cakes. He reminded me that my great-grandfather, T.H. Barnes, Thomas Henry Barnes, had grown up at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, New York, and that those tales that my great-grandfather left for us, those family stories, included stories of that orphanage. And my dad said, according to your great-grandpa, every Sunday dinner at the orphanage was as special and as huge and as delicious as Thanksgiving dinner is these days. Back in those old days, they'd have their creamed onions and their parsnips in orange sauce and baked sweet potatoes, candied sweet potatoes, and a couple different kinds of meats for dessert. This, by the way, was an orphanage that was run by Quakers, founded and run by Quakers in New York City. And it was well endowed, and the Quaker meeting, several meetings that supported this institution, worked hard to make sure those kids had what they needed. So this story about the dinners, the Sunday dinners at the orphanage, was always ended with saying Bolivar cakes. After they'd had their dessert, each child would get to take with them a little fruitcake called a Bolivar cake, because they didn't have evening supper. They just had this big meal in the middle of the day on Sunday. And so the kids would take that with them. And my dad was proposing to make his usual fruitcakes for Thanksgiving. We didn't eat them on Thanksgiving. He would make them the weekend before Thanksgiving, and then he would store them away. So that's what happened on Saturday. We went to the grocery store, and my dad talked about the fruitcake that he was going to make the next day. And the next day being Sunday, we got up early in the morning, and my dad started the fruitcakes, and I helped him chop the nuts and the different fruits. There were apples to be grated and pineapple to be chopped and fresh cherries to be pitted and raisins and currants, two different kinds of nuts. All of that went into the cake along with the eggs and the flour and the brown sugar and the butter, lots of butter. My dad would bake this batter in round pans, smallish round pans. They were actually Maxwell House coffee cans that my dad collected through the year. Most of the coffee he bought from the A&P, but he bought enough Maxwell House that he could use those coffee cans. And when he was finished baking them, he'd pour brandy over them and store them in, wrapped up in dish towels to be stored for the 3 or 4 weeks before Christmas. And then about a week before Christmas, he would wrap those cakes up and ship them off to your aunts and uncles in Western New York, he would say. And the cousins, I would say. And he would say yes to the cousins. Well, that was how we spent our Sunday. On Monday, that was a school day, of course. And at lunchtime on school days, since my parents worked outside the home, I couldn't come home when the school shut down for the lunch hour, as we did back then. I went to my friend Paula Greenberg's house for lunch every day during the week and after school for a few hours. And we spent most of that time watching television, I am sad to say, but sometimes we also had some pretty good meals. Now, Paula's mother was fond of giving us Franco-American or Chef Boyardee spaghetti out of a can, and that was one of my favorite lunches because we never had anything out of a can in my house. So this was a great treat for me. But on this particular day when I walked into Paula's house, to the first floor of Paula's house, her grandma, Bubby, was standing in the kitchen door and waved me in to come into the kitchen. Actually, Paula and I were there together because we were coming home to her house from school, and Bubby wanted us in the kitchen. Now, Bubby only spoke Polish. She had very few English words. She had a few, but she wanted us in the kitchen so that we could smell those delicious smells coming from her kitchen on the first floor. Upstairs, Paula lived with her two sisters and her mother and her father. But downstairs, Bubby had pickled tomatoes in huge half-gallon jars sitting on the table. And she had Kreplach soup bubbling on the stove that she'd been working on all morning. She had knishes filled with kasha and potatoes and a little bit of meat. Kreplach, by the way, is kind of like a ravioli, but it's got chopped liver in it instead of beef. And for lunch that day, Bubby gave us a big bowl each of chicken kreplach soup, and a knish on the side with gravy on top and a few pickled tomatoes. And I had had all of these foods before in Bubby's kitchen. It was delicious. She did tell us that she was going to make a nice roast chicken for Thanksgiving, but she hadn't started those yet. So we made do with this enormous lunch of what she did have prepared. And when I got home from school that day, I was so excited to tell my parents about this wonderful meal that I had had at Paula's house. And I remembered that Bubby was saving the chicken schmaltz, the chicken fat, to make gravy for her roast chicken. And my dad smiled at that. He thought that was interesting. Well, the next day was Tuesday, and it was a school day, and I went to school again. And when I came home from late afternoon at Paula's house and I walked in the front door of our apartment building, I could smell more really interesting smells. We lived on the second and third floor, but the Richardsons, another family, lived on the first floor, Don Richardson and Linda Richardson, and their little 2-year-old daughter, Aisha. And when I walked in to our apartment building, the wall beside the steps that went up to our apartment was a glass wall. It opened onto this nice sunroom they had in the front of their apartment. And the sun was shining through the front windows of the house into that room, and I was peering into the glass windows that went alongside the steps up to my apartment, and Linda saw me, and she came out and said, "You have to come in and taste what I just cooked. You know, we're going to my parents' house for Thanksgiving and we'll have all the usual, but I have to help cook because they're, you know, there's seven of us kids and six of us kids and all the grandchildren. So I've been making a bone-in ham and greens made with the ham juice and chitlins. I've got a big pot of chitlins on the stove. And I had been smelling chitlins a lot when I was a child because there were a lot of people on our street who cooked chitlins. And if you don't know, chitlins are hog's intestines. But I'd never tasted them. And Linda was inviting me in for a taste. So I had a little bit of chitlins and some greens and a little bit of bone-in ham. And when I'd finished there and thanked her, I ran upstairs and told my dad all about this snack that I had. It was dinner time, of course, and I was supposed to be eating dinner, but I'd had this huge snack. Told my dad about what the Richardsons were having for Thanksgiving dinner and said, and Linda saving the ham drippings because she's going to make her gravy with that. And my dad smiled and said, yeah, some people use ham drippings for their gravy. Well, the next day was Thanksgiving Day, of course. I'm sorry, next day was Wednesday. And I went to school again, but we only had a half day of school that day. And when I came home, my dad had been busy cooking all morning. And he had most of the vegetables ready to reheat the next day. And he had all the ingredients out for my mom to make an apple pie and a raisin pie for Thanksgiving dinner. But there was also on the stove this big pan of cow's tongue. Now, I was familiar with cow's tongue because we had it a few times a year, and it tasted good. I did like eating it, but the idea of cow's tongue was always disturbing to me. That tongue was as big as my head. It looked just like my tongue if I looked in the mirror and stuck my tongue out. But it was enormous. It filled a whole pan. And it looked just like somebody's tongue. And I said, Daddy, that's the pan that sometimes we use for roasting things. You didn't forget the turkey, did you? He said, no, I didn't forget. But we're going to have roast tongue for dinner tomorrow for Thanksgiving dinner. I thought that'd be a little different. And I said, no turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. And he said, well, you've been coming home all week telling me about roast chicken and knishes for Thanksgiving and chitlins and ham for Thanksgiving. I think you could expand your horizons a bit and try some cow's tongue for Thanksgiving. Well, I was disappointed. I was not happy. But the next day was Thanksgiving. We got up early and my mom made the pies and my dad assembled everything to go on the table and it was my job to set the table and I did that. It was my brother's job to get into trouble. He was little and he was underfoot everywhere. But eventually it was time to sit down to dinner and the table was set and all the vegetables were on the table and I said, Daddy, do you want me to carry the cow's tongue over to the table? I was trying to be helpful, although I was still a bit miffed. And he said, well, let's see. And he opened the oven door and there inside was the huge golden turkey. He had just been pulling my leg. So we had turkey for dinner after all and all of those wonderful side dishes. And when we had finished dessert, my dad said, I have a special treat for you. And he brought out these small Bolivar cakes filled with cherries and pineapple and apple, grated apple, and all of those fruits and nuts that I'd helped him chop with. And I said, but Daddy, there's brandy. Children can't eat those cakes. They have brandy on them. And he said, well, I saved these for you, and I soaked them in apple cider instead of brandy, and there's enough of these little Bolivar cakes for you to take downstairs to the Richardsons when they get home. And when you go back to school on Monday, you can take some cakes to Paula Greenberg and her family, too. So we had a great Thanksgiving that year, as usual.
That's cool.
Thank you, John. I am over time, so let me end this version of the Epic Radio Hour by telling you this is Fanny Crawford closing out on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The Epic Story Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening. You can stay tuned to hear interview with Larry Summers and David Axelrod podcast next week.